Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg. Hello, it's Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic. Today we're talking with Professor Martin Stadler, who is professor of Egyptology at the University of Würzburg and also a principal investigator on the Magea project, looking at very interesting goings-on in the Egyptian Hellenistic era temple at Edfu. Thought the best way to start this interview was if you would be so kind as to sort of lay out your research project. What are you doing? I know it involves archaeology. I know it involves going to the Temple of Edfu and measuring and all that stuff. But if you could give us an introduction to your work, then we will dive back in and start picking out interesting aspects of it to discuss.
The current project in Magea is connected to my overarching engagement in Egypt right now. It's connected to the Temple of Horus, the sky god Horus, which is found in present-day Edfu in Upper Egypt, and it's the best preserved temple of Egypt, and it boasts a gigantic and most fascinating corpus of inscriptions. So the publication, the French publication that was produced in the first half of the 20th century comprises some 4,000 pages just with hieroglyphic texts. And those texts have not been fully deciphered yet, but they provide fascinating insights into the thinking of the Egyptian priests in the Hellenistic period. So by Egyptian standards, it's a young temple because it was from 237 BCE until 57 BCE. So it's 180 years during which the temple was built and decorated. And when we say decoration, it's a bit misleading because it's not for aesthetics that they want to have a beautiful building, just a beautiful building, but it's also meaningful, this decoration. And you have texts explaining the myths that lie beyond or behind the temple or that are the reason for the rituals that were performed in the temple in Edfu.
Meaningful, but also perhaps meant to be operative, right? Your reading of some of these inscriptions is that they are powerful, operative, magical things.
Yeah, right. The myths are the basis, and the myth is not just that something happened in a most distant past, but that things are active until present times for the Egyptians. So it's a reenactment, a permanent, eternal reenactment of the myth. And that's focused on the temple. And every temple in Egypt had this sort of mythical background. And in Edfu, we are in the very lucky situation that we have an almost complete corpus of texts explaining those myths and this background.
Right. So as opposed to the Isis and Osiris myth, which we get in its fullest form in Plutarch, of all places, right? As a narrative, we actually have the narrative. I'd love to come back to this myth. But before I do, another question for you. Is as someone who knows much more about later magical traditions from the Greek magical papyri onward, am I right in thinking that this is what we call a historiola writ large? In other words, you recite the deeds of gods as part of a magical practice, which brings them into the present. So, you know, from everything from Christian magic to polytheist magic, you have these historioli where you sort of recount the great deeds of a god or gods and that somehow activates the magical spell you're creating. Is that what's going on at Edfu, or is something analogous there to what's going on at Edfu?
It's an interesting comparison to see it as a historiola. It's not true for every inscription. So the typical ritual scene, as we see it in Edfu, shows the pharaoh presenting some sort of offering or prayer towards a deity. And then this scene has a title and also a spell is shortly, sometimes only the beginning of the spell is given that is to be recited during this ritual practice or during this rite. And there you have more allusions to the myths rather than a historiola with a proper narrative sequence of deeds. This happened, and then this person said to, or this god said to this god, we do this and that. That doesn't happen. So we have allusions saying, okay, I present you with the Eye of Horus to make you happy, as Thoth did when he healed your injured eye or something like this. So it's short allusions to a myth that is sort of known to the educated elite performing the rites in the temple. And then we have other inscriptions really explaining at large really long mythical texts with images and with texts. So they have been sort of integrated also through either dramatic performance or through recitation maybe. But in the case of, there's for instance, the great myth of Horus at Edfu, which has been written down in various versions on the walls of, on the enclosure wall of the temple. And one is really the dramatic version, and then you have the poetical version and so on. So we know from other temples also that mythical narratives were designed or also called a ritual. So the recitation by itself was also already a ritual performance.
Okay. So yeah, gives a interesting light on the idea of living narrative, right? The stories are ritual. Rituals are stories.
Yeah, and if I may pick up on that, the myth has a historical reality for the Egyptians as well, yeah? At the beginning of time, the gods reigned as kings of Egypt, and then they were succeeded by the human kings. And the human king, the pharaoh, was an incarnation of the last reigning god of Horus. And here we are again at the temple of Horus in Edfu.
Yeah. Before we move on to more about this specific temple, I just want to get to the how incredible this is as a project. If we it's easy to just go, oh, it's this big temple. But it took literally generations to build this thing, right? And what did that do? How much do we know about what that looked like? Were these giant levies of slave labor? Were these volunteers who designed the temples? Like, do we know anything about any of this stuff? What a work site would have looked like for one of these temples? Who decided where it would be?
That we don't know. We have in Edfu the inscription that describes the building of the temple and also the history of the building of the temple and how then in the end the temple was happily received by the god as his great seat. Right. But about the practicalities, how the masons worked, we don't have any information. And also why this place of the temple was picked. So we have the possibility to make observations. Yeah? We observe that the temple must have been built on what we call a jazeera. This is Arabic for island. So it must have been one of those islands in the middle of the inundation area of the Nile. So this was a place where we had all year a dry place to build then the temple. And then later on, they decided to expand the archaic temple and to build a new, more magnificent temple. And then apparently the temple was turned by 90 centigrees to accommodate this new gigantic building on top of this little island. I don't think that slaves built the temple. They were, I suppose, highly educated craftsmen, masons, artists, and they executed the building work. The same is true, by the way, for the pyramids. We thought about slaves, then about farmers, then being pulled together to build the pyramids. But in fact, we must assume a highly skilled and specialized class of workmen working all year at such a constructing site. And I suppose the same is true for the Temple of Edfu. The design itself says, according to this inscription, that is according to the most ancient scriptures, that have been received from the god of writing, Thoth himself, and that everything has been faithfully executed according to those prescriptions and to those rules as being exposed in these ancient writings. Divine writings.
Okay, so we have a temple of Horus, and like many Egyptian temples, I want to get to magic, but before we do, do we want to talk about the myth? Because it seems like each major temple center in Egypt had its own local creation myth and subsequent kind of unfolding of which gods married which and all this kind of stuff. And the Edfu is no different. We have a lot of detail about Edfu because, like you said, they tell us, which most of these temples don't. And it is sort of relevant to the magical aspects of this temple, right? To have a grasp of this mythological sacred history. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can lay down the Edfu theogony for us.
This is really complicated because we have several versions, again, several versions of the Edfu creation myth or cosmogony. And the most extensive cosmogony that we have, it's, by the way, written down or inscribed just above one of those magical handbooks that I'm studying in the Magea project. And this is also a puzzling fact indeed. Why do we have the cosmogony in this context? But anyway, this text is not yet understood because the form, how it has been written down, the selection of hieroglyphs, the language, and also the system of hieroglyphs used in those times, in the period of the Ptolemies, the Ptolemaic hieroglyphs, open up a lot of space for interpretation. Yeah, so in many cases, the reading is very ambivalent. And if you decide for one reading, you might go into a completely direction. Then if you decide for another reading, then you go to the opposite direction. So this is one problem. But it seems that in Edfu, we have the same basic elements of a typical Egyptian cosmogony, that there is this primeval ocean, and from this primeval ocean, then a hill raises up, or somehow also reed agglomerations in the water help the creator god to find a place where to stand on. And from there, the creator god, which is of course a form of Horus, pre-existing in the primeval oceans, this Horus starts the creation, and thus the temple is the origin of the world. Yeah, and this is recounted with different motifs, with variations in every different Egyptian temple.
I love this about Egyptian mythology, how you can have a god. I mean, this is true of a lot of mythology. I suppose this is true, for example, of Dionysus. But you can have a god who has an actual origin story in the sense that he was born from parents and then was born and was a young god and then grew up, but he also pre-existed that and was the creator of everything. So he can be both at the same time somehow.
Yeah, we have even the concept that a god.
And he can be the pharaoh.
Yes, but we have also the concept that a god can engender himself with his mother. That's called the Ka-Mut-Ef constellation. Ka means the bull of his mother. Mut-Ef is his mother. The Ka, the bull of his mother, Ka-Mut-Ef, means that this god can transgress the boundaries or limitations of time. Yeah, he can go back and forth in time, and he is already pre-existing. And in the case of Horus, it's even more complicated because we have different forms of Horus, different manifestations. So there is Horus of Edfu, who is conceived as a sky god, a heavenly god. And moon and sun are the two eyes of this sky god. But we have also Horus being the son of Isis and Osiris, as being exposed in Plutarch, for instance, and other spells. So in Edfu, Horus of Edfu and Horus, son of Isis and Osiris, can act next to each other. So Horus of Edfu can help Horus, son of Osiris and Isis, to reach his goal to overcome his evil uncle Seth.
Right.
At the same time, Horus of Edfu can also be described as being the son of Isis and Osiris, and there everything gets a bit fuzzy and difficult to understand.
Difficult to understand for us.
Yes.
Maybe. I don't know. I think there must have been really fascinating, for lack of a better term, theological speculations, and even something akin to the kind of mysticism you find in later Christianity in among these Egyptians, thinking about their gods and how they interrelate and how they transcend time and how they're both one and many, all this kind of stuff. I feel like there were, and they can be human, and they were human at some point historically. Also, they're now sort of human in the form of the pharaoh. I imagine there would have been a absolutely cracking metaphysical discussions late at night in the temple, but that's speculation that we'll never know, unfortunately.
Quite possible. And actually, the form how the inscriptions were designed by the selection of hieroglyphs, they also invite us as readers to speculate about the contents of mythology and theology in ancient Egypt. Because if you decide for the reading this very sign in a specific form, you give a certain interpretation to the text. That's the thing which I mentioned earlier with the two ways that you might take. Yeah, and and then you have to argue why you read in this way. And then by arguing for your reading, you use evidence from other religious sources from ancient Egypt, and thus you enter into mythological, theological speculation. And by this, you continue also Egyptian religion until nowadays as an Egyptologist.
Beautiful. So that's what you're doing. I was wondering what you guys were up to. You're doing Egyptian religion. The question then arises, are you some form of priest? Because in discussing what we were going to discuss in this conversation, you said, well, you know, the role of priests in ancient Egypt generally is way too big a discussion to have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, on the social level, on the level of all different things, because priests are just, there are a lot of them and they're very important and they're very complex in ancient Egyptian society. Okay, fine. That's, we can go with that. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about the priests, let's say at Edfu, and just kind of what they did on the day to day, because it is going to be relevant, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because you said you wanted to talk about how they want to protect the god and his temple, right? Mm-hmm. How do you protect a god and his temple? And maybe we need to know first a little bit about what we think a priest at Edfu, priest of Horus, was and what they were doing, right?
Mm. Well, generally speaking, priests at any temple were organized into certain groups, phyles, which is a Greek word. Not every day a priest had service, to fulfill service in the temple. And there were Phylis on duty and Phylis not on duty. So they had shifts. When they had, when the priests of a Phylae were on duty, they had to take care of certain regulations as to ritual purity. There were certain taboos of eating, for instance, fish during this, or to abstain from having sex and so on for maybe 2 months. And then the next Phylae came on duty. What did they do when they were not on duty? They worked in the temple administration. The temple was an economic center. The temple owned lots of lands. They owned cattle. They owned workshops. Everything they needed to keep the business running. So it's really, the temple is a business. And the business needed to be organized and structured. And another project of mine is studying the documentary material coming from this very other temple. We have long lists of bookkeeping accounts of income and for what kind of stuff things were money was spent. It's not really money because that's a rather late concept that was introduced then to Egypt during the Hellenistic period, basically. And yeah, during those periods, they worked as entrepreneurs, I would say. And when they were on duty for ritual practices, they had to perform a daily ritual, a morning ritual, a ritual at lunchtime, and then in the evening also another ritual in the morning to wake up the god, to have the morning toilet, then breakfast, then at lunchtime another thing, and then in the evening dinner. So it's a complete day for the god as a king. And the highest rank of an Egyptian priest was called the Hemnecher, the servant of the god. So they considered themselves as servants, and the high priest of the temple was the Hemnecher. Then we had the Wab Aa, which was a chief priest, so to speak, but this chief priest is below the Hemnecher as the highest rank. The Greeks, by the way, translated the Hemnecher, the god servant, as the prophet. So there was a prophet, the high priest. It doesn't mean that he had insights into the future or prophesied anything, but he was initiated to something. And that, as far as I understood it correctly, is at the basis of the word prophet, to be initiated. That was at least an explanation Egyptologists gave for why the Greeks translated Hemnecher as prophet. Then not every priest, so we had different ranks, not every priest was allowed to enter the sanctuary. We had lower ranks, so the general term for priest is Wab, which comes from the Egyptian word wab, to be pure. So they consider to be a pure caste. Yeah. So they were a caste, we could say, and they called themselves the wabu, the pure ones. So that's the general term. And then among the wabu, we have the great wab, the wab aa, that's the chief priest, who was allowed to perform also daily rites in the during the temple ritual. And then we had the highest rank, that was the prophet or the Hemnecher, the god servant. Apart from that,
okay, that is hugely.
Sorry?
Yeah, go on. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt. You're keep flowing on these priests. Yeah. This is hugely helpful, and just to get an idea of the kind of structure we're looking at here, the kind of activity that's going on.
Yeah, apart from that, we have also the lector priests who were skilled in reading the recitation texts. So they are called the Cherio Habit, the lector priests, so that those who are beyond the book scroll, yeah, because they carry the book scroll from which they read the hymns and all the spells that have to be recited during the daily ritual. And how it really took place, we don't really know. We have mostly the texts to be recited, but we don't know whether they have sort of altar boys helping them, yeah? Or yeah. Is there only the prophet by himself? But this is hard to imagine because he has to do so many things, so many different things. There needs right. to be some furniture, where to put the censer, where to put also the food offerings, and also all the linen they use to clothe and unclothe. First unclothe and then clothe with new clothes, the cult image. I suppose they need somebody to help them as an altar boy. How many, we don't know. So that's the daily ritual. And we have a series of scenes also depicted in the sanctuary in Edfu, breaking the seal in the morning, then opening the nails, then looking at the god, then adoring the god, and then the offering and the cult image ritual can start. And then at the end, everything is closed. So that's the daily ritual every day. And then we have, of course, festivals, and they are more more splendid. You have processions. You go out to certain areas of the temple. Sometimes there's a procession going out even of the temple to a neighboring temple. So we know, for instance, of a big temple feast, during which Horus of Edfu receives Hathor from Dendera, his consort, and then they gather and they have a sort of hieros gamos, and then Hathor of Dendera returns to her temple. And yeah, this happens during festivals every year in a yearly circle.
Presumably the festivals would also involve the laity, right? The non-pure people, the local Egyptian population who can get involved.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, of course.
The congregation, as it were.
Yeah. Right?
Okay, cool.
Yeah, actually, those festivals are an occasion for the laity to get in touch with the god, but they wouldn't see the cult image, because the cult image is always then hidden in a shrine. And the shrine is carried out of the temple in a boat on the shoulders of the priests. And this cult image in some temples, I don't know, we have still to investigate whether it's really true for Edfu, for Thebes, for Karnak. We have evidence that there is a cult image that remains at all times in the temple, and that we have a cult image for the processions that also eventually leaves the temple. But this is an occasion for the wider public, for a congregation to get sort of in touch with a god. And then we have, of course, the living animals, the divine animals. So in Edfu, a falcon, a living falcon, was enthroned as being the manifestation, the incarnation of Horus on Earth. And he was also displayed, yeah, in the middle of the two towers of the entrance gate during the new year. And I suppose this falcon flew away and then came back. And that was, also a spectacle.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, I know your scholarly instincts are not to touch on the temple priesthood because it's so complicated and rich that you can't really do it justice in a short podcast like this. But I appreciate you giving us some small edited picture of what's going on, because it's just, especially for non-specialists, it's really hard. When people say temple priests and you're like, yeah, okay, what does that mean exactly? Mm. It's like, oh, it means this huge hierarchy that is also the bureaucracy of a small kind of self-contained economic unit.
Yeah. Well, not so small. It can be really big. A temple. A temple may own land that is big as a German member state, for instance. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's almost like a provincial government in a certain sense. Now, before we move on, these priests, one of the things they do is feed and clothe and take care of the god all the time. Is the god the statue in the Holy of Holies? is the god the falcon? Is the god all of these things? Now, this, you know, I know about living Egyptian statues mostly from the text Asclepius, the Latin Hermeticum, which is a translation of an earlier, mostly lost Greek, Teleos Logos. And this is, depending on how Egyptian you want to consider it, is either our sort of best description of Egyptian god-making, statue-making, or a Greco-Roman, you know, sort of mishung of Egyptian and Greek ideas. But to what degree is there a statue that is thought to actually contain the god?
Well, I think, I mean, it can be open to debate, but my perception is that those statues are not really the god. They are an offering, or let's say an offer to the god, not an offering, an offer to the god, to manifestate, to come down to earth. Yeah, so like antennas. Yeah, and it's fashioned in the most precious way, so using gold and semi-precious stones, or even precious stones, to invite the deity to come down on earth and to be present when receiving the offerings. But in fact, of course, Horus is much bigger because he's the sky god.
Yeah. Right?
So he's everything around us or above us. And therefore, the statue is far too small. We have then a second incarnation, this living falcon, being then in the shape of the falcon, and Horus of Edfu, as we didn't mention this before, is shown always as a falcon-headed man. So the falcon is the holy or the divine animal of Horus of Edfu. But again, we have enthronements, those animals die, we need a new animal. It's the same as with the pharaoh. He is also in office. He is divine. But before, as a crown prince, he is not divine. In the moment of enthronement, he becomes divine. And then the divine nature goes into his body and he represents the connection between the humans and the gods and connects both worlds. So we know from descriptions in myths, also from stories, that gods are gigantic. Yeah, they are much bigger than human beings, and they can transform into various shapes. And this is one of the great wishes of a human being once you are dead and enter into the netherworld, that you see Osiris as the lord of the netherworld, to see this god. So seeing the god is one of the great goals or objectives of human beings in ancient Egypt. And this must be beautiful, and it's not so different from our, let's say, Christian perspective, to see then the god in the end.
Or the ancient Orphic perspective.
Yeah.
If we reconvene to talk about your work on the Book of the Dead, the Orphics will be there definitely as an alternate test case.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I think we are ready, as non-specialists in ancient Egypt, to talk about your provocative statement that it is in fact important to differentiate between the second order terms magic and religion when talking about the ancient Egyptians, and using Edfu and the cult that happened there and the temple that we still have there as a test case. Why do you think this is important? So what's going on at Edfu that's religion? What's going on that's magic? And how does it help us to differentiate between the two? Listeners who haven't checked out our earlier Egyptological episodes with Svenja Nagel, we talked about this notion of Heka, which is often translated as magic, and it has been rightly criticized that it's not exactly cognate to magic because it is a divine power, which magic is often not seen as. It is also a god unto itself. It can be personified as a god, also something you don't really see with magic. So there's a bunch of differences, but it is the closest concept to magic, right? So what else are we dealing with here aside from Heka?
Yeah, first of all, I would like to explain, I mean, I'm working here now on Edfu and on Edfu texts within a scholarly group researching magic in antiquity. So for some people, this might be surprising to work on a temple text, and to perceive it as a magical text. This is from our tradition, if we go to church is something different from magic. This distinction does not work that neatly in ancient Egypt as it has been established in the West. On the other hand, Egyptologists have tried to distinguish it. But already the great British Egyptologist Alan Henderson Gardiner saw a distinction between religion on the one hand and magic on the other hand. And at the same time, he perceived that there is a close link between both. Because when you perform a temple ritual, you also use magical forces. You use, for instance, Heka, or you have to protect the temple against Heka. Because Heka can be both. It can be good and it can be evil. So we have Heka Nefer, good Heka, good witchcraft, and we have evil witchcraft. And the temple priests have to keep out the evil Heka. And then in the early 1980s, it has become a trend in Egyptology to say, no, there is no distinction between religion and magic. We cannot make this. And with the hard distinction between religion and magic on the one, and with this putting all into one pot and stirring it and then to have one soup, basically, with both, I'm not really happy, I must say. So looking also at the texts from Edfu, we have another term that seems to be very important for me, and that's Ach. And Ach is connected to the root Ach, of course, which means efficient. And this is always positive, a positive magical force, which is used by Thoth, which is also used by the temple priests. The Egyptian priests actually made a distinction between bad and good magic. And Heka can be both. And if we want to go to good magic, then we have to use Ach. And Ach is also something you want to be transformed as a deceased into an Ach spirit, to be an efficient spirit. And as an Ach spirit, you may join the entourage of Osiris in the netherworld. And this is all, as I said, connected to efficiency, but to a good efficiency. And to my mind, although Heka is an instrument, and it's used by priests as well as magicians, it's still not the same, It's not magic, I would say. It's something, it's like a tool that you can use. You can go to your toolbox and take Heka and do what you want with a Heka. You can use it as something dangerous, or you can do it as something helpful for mankind in society or for the creation in general. And Ach is always good. So the distinction is important to me. And I think if we differentiate, we can better understand also how the magic in the temple works. That's my point. A magician, and we have always magicians helping a client to achieve something good. Also, those magicians would use the Ach. So if we define magic as black magic, black magic would be something that would be termed as Heka Bin, as evil Heka, as evil magic in Egyptian. But it can be also good magic. So I would say Hekka is a neutral term. It's neutral, ethically neutral, whereas Aach is not neutral. It's always good.
Okay, but I'm still going to have to chuck out my religious magic binary. They just do not map onto these conceptual worlds at all, it seems to me.
No, no,
Right?
no.
They
But
really
there's a
don't.
difference. If I use Hekka in the temple, then I have a wider context and in mind. Yeah. So I want to preserve the creation. I want to help the solar cycle to succeed and so on. Whereas if I use it in a private context, I want to treat a special problem. Yeah. To heal this woman or to heal a
Help
scorpion sting
childbirth.
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry for my crass use of religion and magic, but I think it's good to come to terms with what we mean when we are talking about these concepts, even if what we mean is these concepts aren't very helpful in this context, which I think is the case here. Let's talk about the magical aspects of this temple. So or maybe the apotropaic active inscriptions that you've been studying. And so what they do, what the temple is meant to do.
The paradox for us may be that the god is perceived as being powerful, yeah, and governing everything. But at the same time, the god has to be protected, which is a sort of contradiction to us. So the temple has been surrounded by an enclosure wall, which is 12 meters high. And we have not just this wall, we have also inscriptions on it with apotropaic texts, with texts that expose the magical protection of the place. Yeah, like the protection of the house, which is one of the ritual texts that I'm studying in the project. And then if we go closer to the god, we have to look at the protection of the body, yeah, which is also title for another apotropaic text. So it goes from the bigger things, the house, the temple, to the body. And although the gods are all powerful, their power is always under threat. Yeah, so that goes back again to the creation, when the world was created. When the sun god was born, the umbilical cord was left over, and the umbilical cord turned into the archfiend of the sun god. And because it's a divine umbilical cord, we have to say it's divine and also immortal. And therefore, this umbilical cord transformed into a gigantic serpent, and the gigantic serpent, yeah, always threatens the world of the gods, and together with the its comrades, yeah, the serpent Apophis, he has got followers, and they always want to attack and how to put it, to destroy the divine order and to gain power themselves, and they have to be defeated every day and every year in a certain circle. Yeah, and that's again then, for instance, in this great Horus myth of Edfu, explained and shown how the sun god grew old and by this week, and that Horus of Edfu had to help him to defeat the sun god's enemies. So, and then Horus of Edfu goes from south to north, and then he pushes the enemies into the Mediterranean Sea. But the next year they are there again and come again, and then you have to do it again. And since this myth is also inscribed on this enclosure wall, we can perceive it as an apotropaic text, yeah, explaining how things have to go. That's on the western inner side, internal side of the enclosure wall. And then if we go to the north, then we have there the protection of the house, which is a long magical text, and it's an adaptation from the royal ritual. Yeah, also the king must be perceived as being surrounded by magic all day, when he got up in the morning and when he got to bed in the evening. Always there was protective magic around him. And from this, the protection of the house, i.e. the house of the king, this has been transformed and adapted for the temple. And the same is true for the other, the correspondent text, which is called the protection of the body. Our translation is bad, actually, because in Egyptian they use two different words for protection. Yeah, so it sounds similar in the English, also in the German translation, but in fact there are two very different words used for protection. And they have been then applied from the royal sphere to the divine sphere. They are used for protecting the divine falcon and also the cult image. And they are combined on this northern section of the enclosure wall symmetrically, yeah, so they correspond to each other. And below them, on the same wall, we have also invocations to the deities, or in this case really goddesses, of the new year, who have to be appeased at the turn of the new year. So the new year is, we have also this superstition in the West, yeah, I don't know how it's called in English, in German it's the Rauhnächte. Yeah, between Christmas and New Year's Eve, you must not put white linen out for drying because it might attract ghosts. So we have the same concept in Egypt that from the end of the old year, after 360 days, we have 5 days extra. They are between the 2 years. And this is a very dangerous period. In a classical year, this would have been around the 21st, 20 to 23rd of June, so in summer basically. And during this time, the Nile inundation would arrive. And in antiquity, everything was put into the channels and into the Nile. Yeah? During the year, all the rubbish, they do it in Upper Egypt still today. And then with the heat, so it's 40 centigrade or nowadays even 50 centigrade in June, you have the perfect conditions for bacteria to grow. And then the inundation comes and everything is spread all over the country. Therefore, the beginning of the year is always connected with diseases, serious diseases, plague, yeah, for instance, cholera, whatever, yeah. And therefore, this transition from one year to the other year is also being perceived of a time during which evil demons can interfere and bring bad luck and also death to the humankind. These diseases were connected with certain goddesses, lion-headed goddesses like Mut, like Hathor, like Sakhmet, and they had to be appeased. So those texts you have also at the bottom or beneath the protective rituals. So if you look at it in a context, then the enclosure wall is not just a physical isolation from the rest of the world, but it's also magically enhanced through the texts and the images.
So it's a sort of architectural talisman, one might say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is absolutely fascinating. One particular detail of your work that I found fascinating is how you've noticed that one text doesn't run, as it were, sequentially along a wall, but bounces back and forth between sides of the temple.
Yeah.
So could you talk about that? Because that's really interesting from the sort of activated magical object perspective.
Yeah. Actually, that's the protection of the house, this ritual text. So we have in Edfu, we have two text witnesses of this text. And in Edfu, we have not just the big Horus temple, but we have also the birth house, which is an extra building in front of the big Horus temple. From the texts, we know that there must have been also further temples in the area, which are hidden, I suppose, beneath the present town of Edfu and haven't been excavated yet. But we have the birth house, which is called Mamisi. And in this Mamisi, the myth of the birth of the divine child is celebrated. And of course, birth and giving birth is also a critical phase during lifetime, both for the child to be born and also for the woman. And therefore, of course, this birth house has to be specifically protected against evil demons who might interfere in a successful delivery. And on the architrave of the Mamisi, or the porticos running around the sanctuary of the Mamisi, we have the second text witness of this protection of the house ritual. And while in the Horus temple, this is written in one section with a clear sequence of texts, and you use the sequence of the individual sentences in the Horus temple. If you use this sequence and want to apply it to the text witness on the Mamisi, you discover that the individual sections do not run around the temple like we would walk around the temple and say, okay, we have here a field with sentence one, then adjacent sentence two, and so on, and then we go around the temple. No, it jumps from one side to the other side and then back and forth. And by this, the text sort of creates a web to cover the Mamisi, and this web is not just a cover, but it's a protective, magically protective cover around this birth house.
This is fascinating. This, of course, is an interpretation of what they meant by doing it this way, but we don't have them saying this is why we've done it in this kind of weird jumping back and forth way.
But we have indicators that the interpretation is still right, because at the corners of the building, we have the invocations to the gods of the south, the north, the west, and the east. And that's the Mamisi version, so they are distributed at the four corners. And to be honest, I have to say that two corners are missing. Yeah, they are not preserved nowadays. But from the preserved corners, the other pair that is missing must be at the missing, nowadays missing corners. And those four groups of gods, they are given in the Horus temple version in one sentence. Whereas in the Mamisi version, they are distributed to the corners of the building of the Mamisi. And this shows also sort of how the protection of the house is spanning up the magical building in which then the mythical birth can be performed.
It's a very beautiful reading of a fascinating piece of architecture. Yeah, you can see how, I don't know if this is a basic magical sort of instinct, but we do seem to see cross-culturally that when you're going to carry out important ritual actions, you sort of consecrate the space you're working in, whether it be as simple as drawing a circle on the floor, which we already see in Mesopotamian ritual practice, but we still see to this day, right? This is a practice that has never died out. Or something more ambitious, like a purpose-built birth house, where you actually are chiseling in a spell, but doing it in a way that kind of creates a force field, like a permanent force field over the building. So it's just activated all the time.
Yeah, you can perceive it as like a tent, yeah? So, by the way, the drawing circles and things on the ground, that's also practiced in Egypt. We have in the book Protection of the House, preceding to the text that has to be recited during the rite or the rituals. Again, now in the Horus temple, we have a section, a narrative section, in which the king describes what he has done before he recites the text. And there he describes that he draws on the floor an image of the Ujjat eye to protect the bed where the god sleeps. And the Ujjat eye is the sound eye that has been restored by the sage god Thoth, because Horus has lost in the battle with his evil uncle Seth, he has lost one of his eyes, and Thoth reconstructed it. And because it's reconstructed and now sound, it's called sound eye, Uja in Egyptian, and therefore Ujjat eye. And by this, it became a powerful symbol for magical protection. Also against the evil eye, of course. And you draw this beneath the bed. So that's something you have also in the Zapel and the protection of the house ritual.
Martin, before I ask my sort of final questions, what else do you want to talk about vis-a-vis Edfu priests' magic that we haven't talked about? What's new? What's interesting?
Well, what I find particularly interesting, I would say, is a point that you raised when you talked about the Mamisi and how it's connected to the space, that this is something that is particularly intriguing, I would say, about working with the Edfu material, because you have the texts working in the space. The space is there, you don't need much imagination, and you can see how the texts are present where you need them, yeah, where you recite them. And through this architectural context, they become meaningful. If you have them on a papyrus scroll, this is also fascinating, because mostly papyrus scrolls are fragmented, and then you have to speculate and reconstruct. You don't need this, but then, of course, the challenge is to make this visible, to make this understandable also in publications, and also in interpreting the temple this 3D thing about the texts, yeah, the three-dimensionality of texts that we are not used to if we read a book.
Absolutely. That's building as text, right? Edifice, yeah, as text, architecture. We often, you know, when we're studying early printed works of the great Renaissance and early modern printing houses, we often, people talk about texts as architecture, because the books are often on the first page, you'll often have architectural details drawn in, and the book will often present itself as a building in one way or another. But this is almost the flip side of that. It's architecture as book, or architecture as text, which is absolutely fascinating. And indeed, if we want to look for something the Egyptians are doing in magic that seemingly is very uniquely Egyptian, this must be it, right? Everyone creates holy spaces. Everyone creates protected spaces, especially when you're talking about magic. But these guys are creating sort of unbelievably elaborate, engineered textual spaces that are talismans, that are, for want of a better word, that are charged with ritual power embodied in the inscriptions themselves, such that they just protect the space.
Yeah, and another thing maybe I would like to emphasize, and also to share with you the fascination for this material. If you don't have an image of the temple, or you haven't stood yourself in the temple and the space, and you're surrounded by all the hieroglyphs, it's really hard to imagine how overwhelming everything is. And then also the fascination how they designed it, yeah, because it looks all perfect. Everything is there where it must be, yeah, also according to the inscription talking about the construction and the building of the temple. And it's fascinating if you think about it, it needed to be designed, yeah? So how do you make sure that in the given space the text really fits in, yeah? So that involves such a lot of design and also of thinking about the design that it's amazing that they could achieve such a wonderful work. And yeah, also imagining how time-consuming it is, yeah? So in the Oxford Handbook of Egyptian Epigraphy and Paleography, there was a chapter by a mason, and he made experiments, and he found out that chiseling two hieroglyphs took him 2 hours. Yeah, and you have millions of hieroglyphs there. So how many? So we come back to the beginning with the craftsmen and who built the temple, but how much workforce did they have? And how gifted they were, how long did they work? During night they couldn't work because they didn't have artificial light.
Well, yeah. This is why we know it was aliens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, you know.
Obviously.
Case
yeah.
closed.
Yeah, luckily they made also some mistakes, so we know they were aliens.
Dang it. Oh, well, so much for my hard argued early aliens theory of Egyptian architecture.
Yeah.
So, Martin, you are working in Edfu. Do you go there once a year? Do you do like a month or two on site? What does the future hold for your current research project? What kind of questions are you asking, trying to answer, and so on?
So the next steps is I would like to have a 3D model of the temple, which is given the dimensions of the temple. So the entrance gate is 30 meters high, yeah. The enclosure wall is 12 meters high and 70 meters long. Given the dimensions of the temple, this is already a challenge, and I, of course, need the help, partners, cooperation partners, being more into digital research on the history of architecture. We have a running project on the sanctuary, so we talked a lot about the sanctuary, but this not very trivial. Where is in fact the sanctuary in the temple? I've got a colleague working on this issue, and we have actually two spaces in mind to be identified as sanctuaries. And the room that to every tour group is presented as the sanctuary is not really the sanctuary, so there's more into it. Currently, I'm really busy with those apotropaic rituals about which we talked. And then a thrilling thing is, if you look into a certain detail, you come up with new ideas almost in every corner of the temple. So therefore, I cannot say what do I have in mind right now. I'm busy also in organizing the funding for the research. That is always quite time consuming and then distracts me from seeing the bigger picture, I'm afraid. But in general, I would say to reconstruct the reality as much as we can, the reality of the cult practice, that we get, yeah, let's say also a visual idea how the cult was really performed. Yeah, and this might be helpful to use digital methods. Then again, I need the help of scientists in computing sciences. Yeah, I cannot do this. I'm working with a colleague of mine in the Technical University of Darmstadt. He is a specialist in digital research on the history of architecture, and he's also specializing in ancient architecture. And the amazing thing is that architecture and ritual and religious conceptualizations go hand in hand. Yeah. So if you go with an architect through the temple, he looks at the building from a very different perspective. But this, again, helps you to understand the temple as an Egyptologist. From where does the light come? Yeah. Why is there a light well And why not in another space? Yeah, why is this space dark, whereas the other one is open, and so on? This has also impact on our interpretation of the temple ritual.
I think acoustics will have played a huge role as well, which harder to reconstruct. Probably
yes,
smells
yeah.
will have played a big role as you were
yes.
burning incense and all that kind of stuff. Whole sensory experience.
Yeah, the acoustics is something that French colleagues investigate for, let's say, the sister temple of Edfu, the temple of Dendera. There is a project going on. They are investigating the acoustics. Yeah, of course, those hymns have to be recited. Were they sung? How were they sung? Yeah, we don't have any musical notation. That's also open to speculation.
Plenty of juicy speculation to come, but in this interview and in your work, you have created a very strong, I think, framework upon which to hang all the speculation, a framework that has a bit of non-speculative ground to it. So thank you for that, and thank you for all your work.
And by the way, earlier you said that the temple has been built over generations. So the temple will be researched also over generations, as long as it has been built, I suppose, or even longer.
If what you're doing is carrying on, in some fashion, the ancient religious rituals of the temple cult by being an Egyptologist studying temples, then it's fitting that you should have that kind of multi-generational approach to the great work, like the ancient temple priest did. Martin Stadler, thank you so much for your time, and stay magical.
Thank you very much.